Something of a magazine episode this time. In the first half, I'm going to pick up on some recent news stories, including the fact that I have been barred from the Russian Federation. And then in the second half, I'm going to address the first batch of questions sent in by listeners. I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow's shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency, and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons, who also receive extra perks and bonuses appropriate to their tier. If you'd like to join them, just head on to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. But now, on with today's programme. So let me start with the, to me, very sad news that indeed, as of the 14th of June, the Russian Foreign Ministry included me on a list of 49 Brits who were being banned from entry, the so-called stop list. And the reason for this is I was actually included, interestingly, and I'll come to this in a moment, on the list of journalists, is that I was... We were all apparently involved in the deliberate dissemination of false and one-sided information about Russia and the developments in Ukraine and Donbass. Our biased assessments contribute to fueling Russophobia in British society, which I must admit I found, well, as I said, I mean, first of all, rather sad, if not wholly surprising. My view has always been that I try and actually present as balanced a perspective as possible. And certainly I have been actually very alarmed by the spread of generalised Russophobia in terms of hostility to Russians as a people and Russia as a country, as instead of, obviously, the Kremlin and Putin and his regime. But this is a nuance that, interestingly enough, is not appreciated either in the Kremlin or on the part of other, again, rather more strident critics of Russia. And as I say, for me, I think more than anything else, it was, I mean, a little bit perplexing, particularly to find myself on a list largely of sort of journalists and people who are involved in the media, like, you know, the Director General of the BBC. Two of us, me and Laurie Friedman of King's College London, the exceedingly eminent defence specialist, were academics, so he was listed as a columnist for the Sunday Times, which, yeah, is a little bit of damning with faint praise. And I was listed as a politologue, a political scientist, and yet there we were in the journalist bit. I must admit, not take great comfort in the usual response, which I sort of had when I announced it, was, well, it means, you know, you're doing something right, or, you know, clearly shows that your analysis is getting under the Kremlin's skin or whatever. Look, there is a wonderful potential heroic narrative there in which I could convince myself or try and convince other people that absolutely it demonstrates that I was seen as a terribly fearsome info warrior and that sort of Putin or senior figures in the presidential administration or even Patrushev himself were saying, no, we can't let this Galliotti figure come in. That would be very, very nice. However, I am depressingly realistic enough to suggest that this rather bizarre list, and I did also incidentally love the fact that the list of persons associated with the defence complex included people like Jeremy Quinn, Minister of State for Defence Procurement, and, you know, Deputy Commander of UK Strategic Command and so forth. Lots of people from particularly sort of two defence industrial sort of complex companies, BAE and Thales, and then tacked on at the end three MPs from the Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland. Who knows? Anyway, I suspect this list was precisely compiled by some intern or the lowest ranking person on the UK desk in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs who was just simply told, for reasons of tit for tatness, we want 29 journalists and we want 20 people within the defence complex. Find some names. he just randomly Googled and put together the list he or she came up with. So, yeah, I'm not really able to convince myself it is an honour after all. From my point of view, I mean, the big sadness is, apart from the fact that I won't get to, for the foreseeable future, until, I mean, I intend to get back to Russia someday, but I suspect it'll be under a different administration. For the foreseeable future, I won't get back to Moscow. I won't get back to sort of travelling around all the other bits of Russia, the ones that I've been to before, the ones I've never managed to get to. There'll be all kinds of people I won't be able to catch up with. There'll become the conversations you can't have. And the sort of, how can I put it, passive and serendipitous research, the overhearing of conversations on the train, the looking in the shops and seeing what's there and what isn't there, the wondering what that particular knot of people or collection of riot police up ahead is and going and having a snoop, all that kind of thing. Which is, let's be honest, probably in part the idea insofar as there is any degree of rationale to this. Whether it's deliberate or inadvertent, I mean, Putin is clearly overseeing an attempt at the North Koreanization of Russia. Not just the disconnection under pressure and under force of its economy, not just a rejection of the political system of the outside world, and I'll come to on that in a moment, but also this sense of not wanting foreigners to come in and bring with them their toxic notions of what the outside world is like, and not letting them have a little poke around and see what's maybe in the dark undersides of Russia, but also, ironically enough, the bright and positive sides of Russia. So, no, it's just another very, very, very small step in this retreat away from the modern globalised community. And, as I've said in the past, back to the 1970s. I mentioned the degree to which people were often saying, oh, it's a great badge of honour or whatever. One other thing that was really quite surprising was I had a number of people saying, well, doesn't matter, you can then actually use the opportunity to go and do the same sort of thing, but in other post-Soviet countries, and obviously Ukraine was the one that was mentioned above all. And I just want to dwell on this, not to have a go at the people who said that, no doubt always in good faith and well meant, but just to stop and think about this. It's a long, long time, I would have thought, that we should have really worked out that Ukraine and Russia are two different countries. That actually an experience of a career of 30 plus years in Russia, working with Russians, looking at the Russian system in all its complexities and peculiarities, does not and should not map directly over into looking at other post-Soviet states. I mean, there is this whole question of whether or not we should actually ditch terms like post-Soviet, the problem being that we don't have an alternative word for a region which does, after all, have certain commonalities of history and everything else. But certainly the idea that I could just simply go and be a Ukrainianist without having any kind of extensive understanding of Ukraine's current politics, without actually speaking Ukrainian, I'm not quite sure how effective using Russian as a research tool would be. That to me is ironic because it actually almost seems to be playing to Putin's own narrative that Ukraine is not a proper country. It is merely a sort of misplaced portion of the motherland that needs to be returned to its ample bosom. And the only real comparison I could give is if, let's say, I was a lifelong specialist in English politics, British politics, who then decided, well, surely I could study the politics of the Republic of Ireland just as easily. After all, a common language, complex, but for large chunks of time, common or at the very least intertwined history. And as well, I mean, even more compellingly, a post-imperial relationship between the Republic and the United Kingdom. I think people would quite rightly look a little askance if I set myself up as if I could be an insta-pundit on matters Irish. So thanks very much, genuinely, for the well-meant advice. But I'm going to stick with Russia, thick and thin. Anyway, enough of that. So, yes, I will not, alas, be travelling to Russia for the moment. And that's sad. Sad for me. And I don't want to say it's sad for Russia. That would be a little bit grandiose. But it certainly will obviously limit to a degree some of the research I do. So let's move on to my persecutor and my personal enemy. I mean, this is the thing, actually. I trust that my publishers will now start hyping my books wherever they are as, you know, the man the Kremlin tried to ban. Anyway, let's move to my persecutor-in-chief, that is to say Vladimir Putin. And he was giving a speech at a very, very much diminished gathering of the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. And it says something when, you know, one of your guests of honour is the Taliban these days. He gave a lengthy speech, and in part I think the length was not just because Putin often is very wordy, but also as an attempt to demonstrate that he was hale and hearty and could give a speech of, I think it was 75 minutes, without having to sort of hold on to a table for grim life or whatever. Anyway, he talked about the Western economic blitzkrieg, in his words, and he basically said that it never had any chance of success. And I find myself wondering, it never had any chance of success, as if in some ways we're now at the point in which one can actually make some kind of serious judgment about the impact of what was, after all, this quite unparalleled economic war that is being waged against Russia. And the answer is, you know, of course not. I mean, I've hyped on about my notion that September is really when we'll start to see things biting. And so is this just him whistling in the dark, seeking to reassure the economic elite of Russia and of such countries as are still willing to talk to the Russians? Or does this actually represent his real view, which would again suggest that people are sugarcoating to an almost diabetes-inducing level what he's being told about the economic situation? Because clearly it is not that the economic blitzkrieg never had any chance of success. It is rather that perhaps there is a rather different definition of what success would be. Economic war takes time. It is slow, but it is incredibly damaging and takes a long time to recover from. So, I mean, if he's really thinking that's it, they've endured the worst that the worst can throw at them, he is in for a very nasty surprise. But a couple of other little points I just wanted to bring up. I said this is going to be more like a sort of magazine-ish episode. There was a fascinating point at which he suggested that he was essentially quite fine with the idea of Ukraine joining the European Union, which, of course, is something that press spokespeople of his have said in the past, but this is something that we've actually got out of Putin, but that he thinks it would be a mistake because he thinks that Ukraine would become a semi-colony, in his words, of the West. Well, I mean, putting aside the fact that I dare say Ukraine would rather be a semi-colony of the West than a full colony of the Russian Federation. But nonetheless, it's interesting because, and it'll tie into something that I'll be addressing in the second part of this podcast, the degree to which even Putin seems to be forced to accept things that once upon a time were considered pretty much anathema. You know, he made the very specific distinction, saying, well, EU, it's just a economic relationship, whereas NATO is military. But let's be perfectly honest, the EU is not just an economic alliance. It is also one that is about governance, and increasingly it is also about security. It has its own kinda sorta Article 5 security guarantees for members, and if anything, the current dynamic within the EU is to take it much more seriously as a security actor. So again, is this just rhetoric? Is this Putin being frankly clueless about the detail of what's involved? Does it represent a change in policy? I suspect not. Or is it just simply an attempt to present the Russian position as being more reasonable than it really is? Because in this respect, actually, Putin hasn't been that reasonable, shall I say, in his rhetoric. I mean, the thing that I love the most was there's clearly a certain spat going on between him and Kazakhstan's President Tokayev. We've got to remember that back in January, although it seems like several years ago, but back in January when there was this, was it an insurrection? Was it a stage-managed coup against former President Nazarbayev? The answer is probably a bit of both. But anyway, at that point, actually Putin stepped in to very much support Tokayev, and there was this deployment of Russian-led forces of Russia's little NATO counterpart, precisely as a statement of that support. Nonetheless, I mean, Tokayev made a point of distancing himself from the idea that the Donbass and Luhansk People's Republics could be considered anything like legitimate structures. He called them quasi-states. And Putin, and again, this is the sort of thing which I think a lot of people will make much, much more of than they should, said at one point, what is the Soviet Union? This is historical Russia. Now, again, people will think, aha, you see, the cat's out of the bag. This shows that Putin wants to reconquer all the territories of the former Soviet Union. He does not. But again, I think it demonstrates this notion he has that in some ways, Russia is an inheritor of the Soviet Union's positive attributes and rights. In other words, it's not to blame for anything that goes wrong, Chernobyl, gulags, whatever, but anything good, obviously that's Russia's, but also that Russia has some kind of privileged status over post-Soviet states as their ultimate defender, just as it did in the Great Patriotic War. Now, usual caveats apply. That's discounting the fact that, in fact, Belarusians and Ukrainians disproportionately actually fought and died in the name of the Soviet victory of the Great Patriotic War, etc., etc. But again, I think this does say something about the kind of unguarded, is it post-imperial? It's not quite imperialist, but shall we say empire-minded notions that Putin comes out with these days when he's not actually thinking and talking carefully. Of course, for thinking and talking carefully, he has to rely on other people. Sometimes it's people like his urbane press spokesman, Peskov, but it's also Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, a man for whom I do find myself consistently torn between pity and contempt. There was a very, very interesting and very revealing, very well-handled interview that the BBC's Steve Rosenberg had with Lavrov, well worth watching, as usual. I'll leave links in the programme notes, in which, I mean, Lavrov was, well, interestingly, first of all, he was talking Russian. He speaks excellent English. Usually he will speak English in these contexts. He was speaking Russian, presumably to make a point. But even in that context, he wasn't just speaking Russian. He was speaking what, if you'd excuse me from calling, is bollocks. I mean, it was quite astonishing the degree to which he was just coming out with the most extreme and most almost offensively unbelievable rhetoric. Claims that, for example, we did not invade Ukraine. We merely announced a special military operation when it became clear that there was no other way that we could convey to Ukraine and the West quite how serious we could call the situation. Well, to say we did not invade, we merely declared an operation, I mean, is a little bit like saying I did not burgle the house, I merely announced a window breakage. The bottom line is it was still my half brick that went through the pane. Rosenberg very, very wisely did not rise to the bait. He could so easily have spent the entire 25 or so minutes of the interview just simply trying to pin Lavrov down on any one of his lies. And if Lavrov has any particular characteristic, it is the one of not being able to be cowed, not being able to be humbled, but above all, not being able to be shamed. But there was this line that Rosenberg himself highlighted, which I think is really important. He asked Lavrov, are you trying to say that Russia is squeaky clean? And Lavrov said, Russia is not squeaky clean. Russia is what it is. And we are not ashamed of showing what we are. Sorry, who we are. And I say, I think that really does, I think, encapsulate the current mood within the Kremlin. It is that sense of, no, we're not going to try and pretend that we're anything other than we are. We're tired of apologising. We're tired of being made to feel like somehow we are the naughty children. We are Russia. We are a great and proud nation, and we will do what we need to do, and you can just like it or lump it. And that's a very defiant, and it sounds quite prideful, but it's also, in many ways, in my opinion, the voice of desperation. It's that voice when you know you have not managed to win the argument. So you say, well, I don't care about the argument anyway. Nya, nya, nya. And that, I think, really encapsulates where so many within the Russian elite, and in some ways Putin himself, is at. This is all they've got left. And it's not something they can back away from. And in some ways, this is illustrated also, this is the last point I want to make before the break, by there was an interesting article by Andrei Pertsev for Medusa, in which he essentially says that when it comes to the current situation in the Kremlin, or the Russian elite rather, and particularly the war in Ukraine, there are basically three parties. There is the party of peace, that would like to see some kind of negotiation and the war ended as soon as possible. There is the party of war, obviously the hawks, who are very keen to prosecute it to some suitable conclusion. And then there is the party of silence. People who basically just don't want to get involved, they're keeping their heads down and frankly hoping that this all blows over. Now, one of the interesting things about the way that Pertsev sort of breaks down these parties is that the peace party is obviously heavily made up of, unsurprisingly enough, economic interests, the people who are really suffering because of sanctions and can see that steam locomotive coming down the tunnel at them. But the particular people he mentions are people like Sergei Chemezov, head of the high-tech and defense conglomerate Rostec, Sergei Kostin of VTB Bank, and also the Kovalchuk brothers. Now, the reason why this is important is these are all people who are actually personally very close to Putin. And in theory, these are the people who actually would have the precisely alternative channels to be able to talk to the boss and a degree of traction with him that others would lack. So, I mean, it remains to be seen, particularly because we'd had from Mikhail Zigar this notion that actually, you know, Kovalchuk was one of the intellectual drivers of the war in the first place, who has spent a lot of time with Putin, and the two of them have been talking about Ukraine and how bad things were and why something needed to be done. So in some ways, this actually gives the peace party potentially a lot more traction than I personally would have given it. I don't know. It may well be that these are still people who, beyond a few articles and speeches saying that actually Russia cannot replace everything that it imports, which is transparently true, maybe that's all they can do. I don't know. But again, that's something to be watching if Pertsev has it right. In terms of the war party, well, I mean, these are the obvious people. It's people like Patrushev, the Federal Security Service, Vyacheslav Volodin, the Speaker of the Duma, Andrei Turchak, who is head of the United Russia Party, Kirienko, whom I covered in the last episode and who seems to be trying to reinvent himself, and the arch reinventor in this case, of course, former President Dmitry Medvedev, now fairly powerless deputy chair of the Security Council, who almost seems to be trying to out-hawk the others, especially through Instagram or some of the social media posts. She's sort of demanding all kinds of things, from whether or not it's time to bring back the death penalty to perhaps the dissolution of Ukraine as a nation overall. And then, of course, when we come to the party of silence, that is essentially the technocrats. As you'd imagine, it's people like Prime Minister Mishustin, people like Moscow Mayor Sobyanin. Now, as I say, I might query a little bit some of the distributions. I think that actually the overlap between the party of silence and the party of peace is a little bit more pronounced. The thing that I found really interesting, though, and to be honest, while I'm annoying people, why not continue with this? If I'd been the editor, I'd have actually said, look, this needs to be added in. There's no real mention of where the military fit in this. Is it because there's just an assumption that the military, being soldiers, they are gung-ho and they want to fight the war? Which, I must say, does not actually correspond with my own experiences of dealing with soldiers, especially senior experienced soldiers, Russian or British or anyone else. They tend to be rather less knee-jerk gung-ho than civilian politicians. You know, when you've had to basically break the news of a death to a loved one or similar, I think you have a better sense of the downsides of war fighting. So, you know, no mention of where the military is or where Shoigu is. And I have a little suspicion that really, if we were going to categorize him, to a degree, Shoigu might fit within the party of silence. Yes, he is defence minister, so he can't be that silent. He has to be out there every now and then. But for someone who is a very, very effective and assiduous PR guy, Shoigu has been quite strikingly absent from the newspapers and the TV screens, given that there is a war on. Now, some people characterise this as demonstrating that he's somehow in disgrace or whatever. I'm not convinced about that. I've seen no serious evidence of that. I can only assume that this is actually Shoigu trying to keep his head down, insofar as I say, the defence minister can during a time of war. But still, I think the underlying leitmotif, while I might quibble with some aspects of this article, I mean, Petusev knows his stuff, he's clearly got good contacts, but I think what it really underlines is this crucial point, is that yes, Putin is ultimately the final arbiter. But on the other hand, there is still room for palace politics, if nothing else, of people who are gathering, conspiring, talking, exploring different policy options. And when the time is right, and I think it must be very difficult at the moment, but when the time is right, hoping to be able to nudge the president in the direction they would see fit. Again, I think the issue is at the moment that there's actually very little scope for distracting or diverting the president from his war. But that doesn't mean to say that people won't try and do it. And yes, some people will want that to be in the direction of escalation. But if anything, probably a majority would be in favour of some kind of de-escalation, not because they're nice people, but because they are practical, ruthlessly practical people. So that's something that in some ways offers us a little glimmer of hope. Anyway, let's have a break now, and then what I'm going to do is address some of the questions that various listeners have sent in. Just the usual reminder, you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. You can support it by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the show. So I'd asked people to send in questions on topics that they would like me to address, and I had an excellent selection. Frankly, far more than I could cover in any one episode. And also I thought that would make it a very, very sort of choppy type of program. So instead, what I'm going to do over the next two, maybe three podcasts is devote one half of it to addressing questions, which I'll have clumped together. And so today I'm going to be mainly looking at, shall we say, geopolitical issues. And then the next time it'll probably be domestic Russian politics. So, in terms of questions, the first one that I was asked was precisely about Finland and Sweden and the prospects of their joining NATO and quite what Russia, what the Siloviki would do as a result. And to be perfectly honest, my answer is I don't think there is a great deal they can do. And this is something that I think that Putin himself appreciates. Not that he's happy about it. Because it was quite clear that what happened at first when the conversation about joining NATO started, there was the usual swagger and bluster coming from Moscow, which in the past has often helped to actually deter these countries from really sort of moving forward with it. It's been enough to sort of activate communities within these countries who think, oh no, we shouldn't be provoking the Russians and such like. This time, though, for obvious reasons, they went ahead, they ignored all this, and it was the Russians who were essentially forced to back down, and Putin himself was then said, well, frankly, as long as there's no military infrastructure that threatens Russia, why should we care? And that is, as I said, definitely a backing down. And I think it speaks to a much, much more wider and, for me, really interesting thing that's happened. So much of Russia's might in geopolitics of late has been based around bluff, has been based around this sense of we're really powerful, but we're also really unpredictable, so you don't want to challenge us, you don't want to push us into a corner because, oh, who knows what we might do. And that has actually been very, very effective because, let's be honest, in particularly in geopolitics, so much of power is about perception. It is about, do people think you are both able to deploy some kind of force, whether it's economic or social or soft power or military, and do you have the will to do so? And so, you know, basically, Putin was running a pretty big bluff. Now, when he invaded Ukraine, when he bit off far more than he could chew as a result of that, he became one of the only real figures in history I can think of who could be said to have called their own bluff. And now he is, therefore, in a much, much weaker position. So, yeah, I mean, I think that Finland and Sweden can expect the usual kind of harassment that one would see from the Russians, you know, bombers flying close to, maybe even just nipping into their airspace, an upsurge in cyber attacks, attempts to characterise the regimes as somehow sort of allying with fascists or anything else. But this is basically Moscow on autopilot. I don't think there's going to be anything that much more substantive than that, because precisely there just aren't the resources, military, political, or whatever, to go beyond that. So on that, I'm actually kind of relatively comfortable. Another question came about, okay, given what's happening in Ukraine, given the extent to which Russia is having to funnel so much of its available and operational forces there, what does this mean for the flanks? What does this mean for the Arctic, for Central Asia, for the Caucasus? You know, essentially, can Russia continue to assert power there? Will it actually have to sort of back away? Will it create vulnerabilities? Well, let's run through these. And I think in pretty much every case, what we see is, shall we say, a policy commitment to maintaining a high profile and a substantial role there, a military role there, but already being undermined by the realities of the situation. Take the Arctic, for example. I mean, we had the announcement recently that, for example, they were standing up again an air base on the Kola Peninsula, Severomorsk 2, which was closed down in 1998. We do see, after all, a continued commitment to building forces which are capable of operating within Arctic environments, whether we're talking about, you know, squadrons of aircraft that can patrol the waters of the high north, or ships, or indeed specialist Arctic warfare troops. And this is one of the interesting things. I have not yet sort of noticed any reference, and if any of my listeners are aware of this, please do drop me a line. There are a couple of specialist Arctic warfare units, which I don't see as having been called on to send or generate battalion tactical groups to send to Ukraine. Now again, please let me know if I'm wrong, because if I am wrong, well, that actually shows that there's nothing special about these forces. But on the other hand, if I'm right, it does suggest that Moscow, even in its desperate need for manpower, is still trying to protect these two brigades. So that's an open question for you. But nonetheless, I mean, we have to bear in mind that for all the military posturing in the Arctic, this is not primarily a military theatre in the sense of, this is more about economics, and this is more about posturing. I mean, there is an attempt by the Russians to basically stake a claim to stewardship of the opening waters as the pack ice recedes, which is going to become potentially a very important trade route in the long term, and also control over or access to the priceless hydrocarbons and other mineral resources underneath the Nordic waters. And, yeah, fine, they're building up their military forces, but if you just look at the sheer length of Russia's northern coastline, I mean, it is clear that actually militarily trying to control that would be a fool's game. So in the Arctic, I think it's all going to come down to resources. And already we're seeing that because of global warming, we're seeing not just cities, but also bases beginning to become untenable, beginning to sink into the permafrost. The Russians are going to have to spend a lot of money just to maintain their current force posture in the Arctic, let alone actually extend it. And, well, that money is not going to be easily found. What about Central Asia then? And in that context, I suppose, Putin's apparent little spat with Tokayev, including Tokayev actually rejecting an award of the Order of Friendship, apparently on the grounds that there is a ban on accepting decorations while you're in office. But, you know, but still, the fact that it sort of came out was quite telling. In that context, I think very much it again shows that although Russia is still committed to maintaining its status as the security guarantor of choice in the region, we've seen, for example, some more forces, or some more equipment at least, being sent to their base in Tajikistan, which is there precisely to help in case of some kind of jihadist surge from Afghanistan. It'll all depend on just how credible this is. And that's the longer-term issue. I mean, is Russia going to be in a position in which it can actually project force quickly and successfully into the region? I honestly don't know, for example, if the Kazakhstan crisis blew up today, whether or not, given the degree to which Russia's airborne and special forces are being deployed to Ukraine, whether or not they could have as easily, certainly as quickly, have sent the same kind of reaction force. The answer is probably not. So I think this is going to be a real crisis. Again, it's all very well sort of planning to maintain your role as regional military guarantor. But to do that, you need to have the will and the forces. We shall see. Because the Caucasus, again, there we already, Russia has had to accept Turkey as a player. Russia has had to accept that, you know, its capacity to keep this as its absolute sphere of influence without any other nations operating within it is already under pressure. Frankly, in the Caucasus, the Russians were quite successful in making the best of a bad job, injecting themselves as peacekeepers into the situation between Turkey-backed Azerbaijan and, frankly, no one really backed Armenia. But the bottom line is Armenia was a member of Russia's military alliance, and Russia did nothing really to stop it from being truly hammered by the Azeris. So, you know, what we're actually seeing in many ways is precisely an imperial retreat, and I think Ukraine is only going to accelerate that process. Of course, part of Russia's strength has always been not just its regular military, but its nuclear forces. And I was asked a question about, again, the odds of Putin turning to some kind of nuclear response as he comes under pressure in Ukraine. I really want to stress that Russia's military doctrine has often been quite dramatically misrepresented. It very clearly states that Russia would only use nuclear weapons in the case of an existential threat to the very nature of the Russian state. In other words, no, not instability, not some kind of escalate to de-escalate way of managing a conflict, an existential threat, full stop. Now, okay, this is just the doctrine. This is just, in some ways, a piece of paper. But it is a very, very important piece of paper in the whole way in which the Russian military structure and think about war. Doctrine drives everything else, from personnel to procurement to how you structure your forces to even how you just conceive of war. And in theory, Putin could just ignore it. Putin could just simply say, to hell with doctrine, I fancy sending a nuke against Lviv. And in theory, there's nothing there to stop him. Just as there's nothing to stop an American president who goes insane from launching a preemptive first strike. In practice, though, I do wonder if Putin did something that was going to be so evidently suicidal, whether that is precisely the kind of thing that would actually get his own generals or his own elite more broadly thinking, no, the old man has gone too far, he's become too dangerous to us all. But in any case, I think the key thing is this. The more Putin talks about the nuclear threat, and he kind of hinted at it in his St. Petersburg International Economic Forum speech, then actually I would suggest the less likely it is, precisely because he turns to things to try and intimidate because he's not planning on using them. And certainly we haven't seen a single sign that the Russian nuclear forces are in any way being stood up in any kind of preparatory stage for the use of even tactical weapons. And I've talked about tactical nuclear weapons in the past, so I won't go into that more now. So, nukes. Insofar as one can ever be optimistic when it comes to nuclear weapons, I think we can. What about the fate, though, of the potential regions that might be being annexed, whether it's just the DNR and the LNR, the Donbass and Luhansk People's Republics, or the sort of broader array, South Ossetia, Abkhazia, maybe even Belarus? Would they ever become independent again, or would Ukraine be able to recover them? Well, look, one can never say never when it comes to geopolitics. If you look at history, boundaries change. Countries expand, countries contract, countries fragment, countries accumulate. On the other hand, I think one would say that territories that Russia has annexed under Putin are extraordinarily unlikely to be relinquished under Putin. I think that's all one can really say. I cannot see him being willing to actually back down when he has gone all the way to annexation. Whether or not that actually means that they would stay in that status after Putin is a whole other matter. And I mean, particularly if one looks at DNR and the LNR, it's so hard to know precisely what opinion is like within these poor, benighted regions. It is different from Crimea, where there has been a certain amount of effort into trying to build some kind of economic uplift and such like, even though it hasn't necessarily been especially effective and certainly being now, again, wasted with the war. But those regions, I mean, they didn't really want to become part of Russia in the first place. That was never what the risings there were about. It was about people who were scared and dissatisfied with what was going on in Kyiv, who were worried that they would face some kind of an anti-Russian speaker backlash, or just simply were trying to renegotiate their relationship with Kyiv. This was, insofar as there was a genuine protests and risings there, it was about autonomy, not independence. I find it hard to believe that the experiences of the past 8 years have been so wonderful that they would say, nope, now it's Russia or bust. Especially if Ukraine does actually manage to make a go of building itself as a progressive, modern and economically dynamic European state. I mean, in those circumstances, and again, I would stress we're talking about a post-Putin future, I think it's almost inevitable that actually the dynamic would be for either rejoining Ukraine or as some kind of halfway house, leaving the Russian Federation perhaps as some kind of separate state that could in due course gravitate back towards Ukraine. But I think, again, this is the point. It's very much going to be for the Ukrainians to demonstrate that that is in their interests. The other areas, the ones that fought so hard against being controlled by the Russians in Zaporizhia and so forth, I think that basically as soon as they get a chance, they would want to be back in Ukrainian hands. And given that they would be an expense for Russia, an expense to have to administer, an expense to have to secure, probably against a long-term insurrection of some kind, again, I could see a pragmatic post-Putin regime making some kind of a deal that allowed them to hold a vote. I'm sure it would demand a price for that, but I think it will happen. What about Belarus? Well, again, I think that even if Belarus is brought back into the embrace of Russia, Belarus is not Russia. Yes, there are all kinds of different similarities. And yes, Russians actually have an interestingly positive outlook on Belarusians. And certainly until the Russians decided to back Lukashenko, a lot of Belarusians had a certain positive attitude toward Russia. But again, you can't walk back some things. Actually, supporting Lukashenko against his own people and then essentially forcing this into some kind of union or Anschluss with Russia, these are not the things that positive long-term friendships make. So again, I think at some point, Belarus would once again be given the opportunity to make a choice. And again, it may well be that Moscow would constrain that choice. It would simply say, do you want to be independent as long as you agree not to join the EU and NATO and such like? But nonetheless, independent it is. So I think this is it. These annexations are, I mean, firstly, terrible in the sense of the fact that they would very much limit the opportunities for any kind of a peace deal with Ukraine. They would absolutely make the war drag on that much longer. Terrible in that they clearly do not represent the will of the people in these regions. I mean, maybe South Ossetia, but even there, quite possibly not, given that the newly elected president of South Ossetia himself has backed away from the idea of a referendum, which would involve kind of reconnecting to the North Ossetians within the Russian Federation. Generally speaking, the sad truth, Mr. Putin, is no one else wants to be your subject. No one else wants to be part of your regathering of the Russian lands project. And it really will not last. And a very, very final, very, very kind of specific point that I was asked is, is it likely that the Russians might recruit children in the DNR and the LNR? And that, I would say no. Yes, we're going to see conscription, often quite ruthless conscription, people also who have, let's say, health and social issues, which would mean that they shouldn't be being conscripted, or people who are older than they ought to be being forced into service. But I see no signs that they're actually going to be recruiting children. This is not either a war in which child soldiers are necessary or desirable, but nor is it, and think about damning with the faintest of praise, nor is it that even the Kremlin is looking to basically emulate Pol Pot and deploy armies of children with Kalashnikovs and little else. So I suppose that counts as, again, the closest thing to a positive way to end this particular segment. So, just one point, someone asked actually about Girkin Strelkov. For me, talking about him is something that actually I want to devote a whole segment to, so that will come in due course. But as I said, broadly speaking, next episode, questions will be essentially about domestic Russian politics. I have enough questions really for another 1.5 segments, so there's room for a few more. So if anyone else wants to sort of bounce something my way, I'll happily address them. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well. И только будь, пожалуйста, со мною, товарищ прав.